We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls today. Europe in the 17th century was a place of religious wars, pestilence, and plague. Most people did not live past 30. In London at the time, more people died than were born. And to the extent that people felt they had a relationship with God, that relationship was generally defined by one word, fear. But in the midst of all of this chaos, there were a few men who saw a different kind of world. They saw a world of perfect order, a place that ran with the precision of a fine clock, according to laws resting on the solid base of mathematics. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Edward Dolnick about his book, The Clockwork Universe. And it is a book that profiles some of the most important scientists of this time. Isaac Newton probably was the leading light among them. Talks about their work, how it is they tried to understand the world, what their motivation was, and how the kinds of understandings that they developed still underpin science and our understanding of the world today. The book has come out recently. It's published by Harper, so if you're interested, you can seek it out. Our guest, Edward Dolnick, is the author of a number of other books, including The Forger's Spell, Down the Great Unknown, The Rescue Artist, and Madness on the Couch. He's former chief science writer at the Boston Globe. He's also written for The Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, and many other publications, and he's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Your questions are welcome. We hope people can be brief and on the topic. But otherwise, you can call in and join the conversation. We'd be happy to have you. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk, so that is W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And Mr. Dolnick, hello. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good.
Good, good. You know, I'm sure that people play this parlor game when they say, well, if you had to live at some other time other than this time, what time would it be? I think perhaps, though, if we really knew what it was like to live in some of these times and places, we wouldn't if we had the choice. But say, take this specific time where you begin in this book. Say we could go back to London in the year 1660, how would we find the place?
Well, this question of time travel, where you would like to go, is a fun one. We tend to make the mistake, generally speaking, of thinking that we would be exchanging witticisms with Queen Elizabeth. Say, statistically, we'd much more likely be paupers or be in some gruesome slum. London in 1660 or so, which is the age I'm writing about, the age when the modern world was born, would be to our eyes and ears and noses a horrifying place. It was crowded. It was filthy. There's essentially no sanitation. There's heaps of human waste blocking the streets. Butchers throw the leftovers from their shops out into the roads. You have to navigate this these heaps of trash. It's really a world that would have startled us if we could have suddenly transport ourselves there.
So there, I guess one of the things that you're talking about here is how it is, how that affects your mindset, your way of thinking, how you think about things work and whether, in fact, things make any sense. And that perhaps to many people, you'd look at a world like that and say to yourself, who's in charge here? Obviously, nobody's in charge. This couldn't have been terribly well designed, or if it was, the designer set things in motion and then went out for coffee. This doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, that's exactly how we would look at it. And what intrigued me, what set me to writing this book, was the contrast between that chaos all around you, and on the other hand, somebody, Isaac Newton and people like this, looking out and saying, no, no, that's only what's on the surface. If you look beyond that, if you look deeper, you will see perfect order behind the apparent chaos. Mm-hmm. How people could believe in that order in the midst of such mayhem was what I wanted to get at.
Yeah, and maybe one of the things that certainly we will talk about, and I think one of the major points that you're trying to make is that as we look back to these figures, people like Newton and others, Kepler and Galileo and Leibniz and, you know, people like that. Well, I guess Galileo maybe is a little bit earlier, but these sorts of people. And we see how far-seeing they were, we tend to think of them as basically being like us. And one of the main points that you're trying to make is, no, they're not like us.
Right. It seems when we think of them, and we still know their names, at least some of them, Newton certainly, Boyle, in high school, people learn Boyle's Law. It has to do with gases and pressures and volumes. Nobody knows who Boyle was, but the names live on. And so there's a tendency to think that they were just like us, except that they wore funny wigs.
Mm.
But as you say, they weren't like us. What they thought they were doing, the reason they were interested in science, the reason that they believed that if they looked hard enough, they would find an answer. All these things were quite strange, quite different from what we take for granted.
Well, let's talk some more about that. As to us, we do science. Well, we're trying to get a better understanding of how the world works, why things happen the way that they do. Now, it would seem to me that if you look at someone like Isaac Newton, you'd think, well, his motivation was the same. He was trying to get a better understanding of how the world works and why things happen as they do. But what was his goal there, his reason for doing that, so much different than our reason for doing science now?
Well, his motivation was different. Newton and all his peers were profoundly devout men. They believed that the universe, down to its tiniest aspect, had been organized by God. Everything in the world, everything that happened to you, whether you were sick or healthy, whether your children had lived or died, whether a turtle has a thick shell or a thin shell, whether there's one sun or two, every feature of the universe, from the most trivial to the most significant, represented a decision by God. It was something that God had put in order for reasons of his own. And the task of science was to read God's mind.
Mm-hmm.
The scientist was therefore, according to Newton, performing a religious duty. What he was doing was understanding on the one hand what God had done, and then on the other hand explaining to the rest of the world how majestic and how intricate God's creation was. That was the point of studying science. It wasn't to satisfy your curiosity. It was to pay homage to the Creator.
So in a very real sense, the idea was that if you looked at it carefully enough and you had the right kind of tools, that what you could do was in understanding the creation, you would be able to understand the mind of God.
That was the notion. You could read God's mind, a profoundly grand ambition. When we look at the world today, there's any number of things that our answer why, to the question, why is that, is it just so happens. Why is there one sun? Why is the moon the precise size it is? That kind of thing isn't for a reason, we don't think. But to Newton and his peers, everything had been designed. It was as if every feature of the world was a feature in a novel written by a brilliant novelist. You wouldn't say, oh, why does it so happen that the main character is a man or lives in London or some such thing? Each decision like that would represent in the novel a decision by the author. And in the same way, every feature of the universe, these scientists in the 1600s believed, every feature in the universe represented a decision by God.
Mm-hmm. And here, again, another of the points you make is that it's kind of ironic that they people like Newton and these other scientists who had this motivation, that is, they wanted to understand the mind of God, they did such a good job that they kind of nudged God out of the picture. That and certainly they didn't intend that, and maybe they would be unhappy about that if they knew that's the direction science had gone.
There was a marvelous catch-22 built into all this, which, just as you say, is that against all odds, the profoundly devout Newton does demonstrate that the world follows these mathematical laws. You can predict exactly where a planet will be tomorrow if we know where it is today. We can know exactly what the path of a cannonball or an arrow will be. The world isn't a haphazard place. It's a precise mathematical place. But to say, to prove, as Newton did, that the universe follows mathematical laws did seem to shove God out of the picture. And that was the message that all the scientists who followed Newton took from his work. They said, this is brilliant. This is the clockwork that God maybe set in motion once, and then, just as you say, he went out for coffee. This is a notion that would have had Newton tearing his hair out in rage. It was the opposite of what he believed, and yet it was what everybody who followed him took to be the message of his work. And people would say, we're paying homage to Newton just as he proved. We see that we don't need to talk about God anymore. Mm. He would have hated that moral.
I think we're also used to the idea that people like this often came into, because what they said was sometimes revolutionary and seen to be radical, that they came into conflict with the established authorities of the time, and among the authorities of the time would have been the leadership of the church. Given that these men had this deep faith and that they ultimately had this kind of religious motivation, how did the religious establishment feel about them and what they did?
Well, this is a terribly important question that you ask. One fact of the birth of science is that Galileo dies in Italy, and in the same year that he dies, Newton is born in England. And that serves as a kind of mnemonic device that the great advances in science had been in Italy at one point. And then with Galileo, that stops. Italy becomes a backwater, and the vanguard of intellectual action moves to England with Newton. And the reason for that is that in Italy, the church had set itself up as an opponent of science. The Bible told us that the world was one way, and now these scientists had come along and said it was something else. So Galileo, as everyone knows, does battle with the Inquisition and loses that battle. But in England, the church took a different in cagier tack. The line that the church took in England was that these scientists were indeed showing the majesty of God's creation. Science didn't contradict the Bible, but proved the majesty of God's creation. And where there seemed to be creation, that was because the Bible necessarily had to appeal to all sorts of people, including the unlearned, and so there were certain passages in it that seemed not to fit with science, but those were not to be taken literally. That was metaphor, so that everyone could understand God's message. But the true message was that science and religion were allies, not rivals.
Our guest in this hour focus, Edward Dolnick. He's a science writer. He's former chief science writer at the Boston Globe. His new book is The Clockwork Universe, the subtitle Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World, and it's published by Harper. And we have a caller and would welcome others who'd like to join the conversation. Pick up the telephone and dial the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, to Belgium, nearby, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I don't quite understand. It seems to me these people had a limited view of what life was in some ways, because in these large cities in northern Europe and stuff, yes, things were horrible, but crowded and filthy and everything else like that. But there are many places in the world where those conditions didn't exist, but these people weren't aware of it. So they took a negative view of things when really other people, though they may not have been as learned in some ways, but were living completely normal, clean, healthy, undiseased lives until the Western Europeans showed up at their doorfront, i.e., most of the native peoples in the rest of the world.
Yes. The gruesome aspects of life I'm talking about were life in a particular place. That this is Europe in the 1600s had this disease that I'm talking about. Chaos in the streets. Other parts of the world looked quite different. The reason for my focus on this particular part of the world is that I was the subject of the book is the earliest scientists, and it so happens that where these early scientists were the great cities of Europe.
I see. Even though they didn't really, obviously they couldn't look at some of these other places in the world because they weren't there, right?
They didn't know about these other places. But this was, in a sense, a provincial era. They wouldn't. It was later notion, people like Rousseau, that there would be something to be learned from these other ways of life. For these scientists, like Newton and Christopher Wren, the notion that you would look to a place without grand cathedrals, without technology, and there might be lessons to be drawn from that, that wouldn't have been a notion that made sense to them.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, it does seem that the places, the disciplines in which people like Newton and these others were particularly strong had to do with, for their putting them in the context of their time, were particularly strong were mathematics, physics, astronomy, but that there were some pretty basic things about chemistry and about living things that they really didn't understand. They seemed to do a lot better with things that were dead or that never had lived than with things that were living. It's assuming that I've got that right. Is there a particular reason why that's maybe easier, or maybe it's the place where you start?
Well, it's an awfully good question. Essentially, just as you say, physics comes along early and biology comes along much later. So Newton is in the middle of the 1600s and Darwin is in the middle of the 1800s. But a surprise in that is that what Newton did to this day remains terribly hard. It's in equations, it's in mathematics, which is very hard for most of us. His most famous work, Principia Mathematica, is like the world's hardest geometry book. What Darwin had to write about is written in ordinary words. It's in English. It's about pigeons and barnacles. And yet it was an idea that took 200 years longer for people to come up with. And so why is that?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is that for Newton and his peers, this notion that the world had been designed by God was so fundamental to them that they didn't think, it didn't make sense to them to consider an alternative. If there was design, there had to be a designer. They didn't regard that as an argument even. It was simply truth. It was so plain. There could be no alternative to that. It took Darwin to come along and say, yes, the world can look perfectly designed the way a bird can fly or a fish can swim, and yet there was no hand of God designing that. There was a different system, which Darwin explained, which was evolution and natural selection. That seems to us like an easy idea because it doesn't have equations and mathematics in it. But we see historically that it must have been a terribly hard idea. It's still hard for us today, and it took 2 centuries for these great geniuses to come up with it. 2 centuries after Newton and these other huge intellects, they never did fathom it. Newton and the rest.
Yeah. Well, we certainly don't want to underestimate or understate Newton and his achievements. This man who said, "Well, it's actually possible to read God's blueprint for the creation, and you can use mathematics to decode that." But before he could do that, he actually had to invent the mathematics to do it. So he invents to the displeasure, I'm sure, of many students since, invented calculus so that he could have some way of describing and analyzing things in motion. So you can't, the fact that he had this idea and then actually had to invent the tools to do the work, you have to acknowledge that was a very big thing.
No, I'm thrilled to acknowledge it. Newton is one of the astonishing intellects there ever was. And even in the course of this book, if I would interview Nobel Prize winners, say, they would say, well, we're jealous of one another, that we think, boy, I could have thought of that. But even these great vain figures didn't presume to compare themselves with Newton, let alone to be jealous. That would be too presumptuous. This is some kind of different league. This is Michael Jordan compared to pick up games at the Y. It's almost impossible to put on a scale, these scientists say, just how astonishing Newton's mental abilities were.
Mm.
In this business of calculus, what the Greeks had done, the Greeks had been brilliant mathematicians, and what they had known is all the things we learn in geometry. If you have a circle, you can say these things about it, and if you have a sphere or a pyramid. But they had talked about things that you could draw on the blackboard, like a circle or a sphere. The great astonishment of what Newton did was, if you take that sphere and shoot it out of a cannon, where will it go? How fast will it be going when it smashes into a castle wall? How high will it be at its peak? The Greeks had no way to answer those kind of questions. They could answer static questions about things just sitting there in a drawing in front of you. But when you set those things moving, when you essentially press the on switch and set the world going, the Greeks didn't know how to deal with that, and nobody did before Newton and Leibniz, his contemporary, who invented the same thing.
Mm.
They both invented calculus. They both figured out this way of analyzing what happens when the world starts moving.
We have some other callers, so we will talk with someone in Champaign next. Line one.
Wow. Since calling up, I realize that I'm going to my question, which I formed in your mind before I heard that last bit of conversation, is going to kind of contradict what you're saying. What's going through my mind is that both Leibniz and Newton came up with calculus at the same time. Also, in some ways, I would say, or let me put it out to you, that Newton was necessary for Darwin because it was the very breakdown of that idea that God designed everything that allowed Darwin later to make his advances. So my question comes down to how much our individual genius, and Newton was, of course, how much your individual genius versus just a general progression of science. Obviously, calculus was ready to be invented because two people came up with it at the same time. But of course, but the origin of species wasn't ready in Newton's time. And that's my question. It's the interaction between scientific progress and whether the same things would be found out maybe 20 years later or 30 years later by some other genius if Newton had been run over by a cart in the streets of London. Thank you.
All right.
Well, it's a terrific question. You've got quite an audience. I think that the caller is absolutely right. If Newton had been run over, we know for a fact that somebody else would have come up with calculus. It's true of all the discoveries in science. If Einstein hadn't said E equals mc squared, someone soon after would have. In contrast, if Shakespeare had not written To Be or Not To Be, we would never have that line. So science is much different in that way. There is a notion of ideas in the air and things make progress. And we, in a sense, it's misleading that we put these names on, that the scientific revolution is Newton and it's Boyle and it's Leibniz, because it could well have been different people. And if they hadn't been born, you do think that someone, probably before too long, would have come up with these notions. It's a profound difference between a field like science, in which progress is clear and indisputable, and a field like literature, in which it would take quite an argument to say that Homer was less able than Proust or James Joyce. Different, but the notion of progress in literature is not the same as the notion of progress in science.
All right, let's go to Urbana, line two, for another caller. Hello.
Yes, I guess would like to suggest that perhaps the evolution of evolution and of the botanic and biological sciences wasn't quite that instantaneous. The groundwork was laid almost as early as Newton. People like Linnaeus and Mendel were there laying the groundwork only a few years after Newton. And we have some people working in the biological sciences, including our own Cotton Mather, who was not only a minister, but I believe some of his, was it about 400 works? About half of them dealt with the sciences. And I believe some of those were the what we would call biology today. But the great innovation of Darwin was not evolution. That had been around a long time. In fact, his grandfather wrote out a theory of evolution nearly as complete as his own, minus natural selection, two generations earlier. And did it in, was it couplets? Rhymed couplets?
Well. Yes, that's all so. Everything the caller says is so, that Darwin, too, doesn't rise out of the blue. The surprise to me is that what Darwin came up with, you might anticipate that someone as brilliant and as curious about the world as Newton or one of his contemporaries would have beat him to. And Darwin himself had an inferiority complex. He wasn't good at math and was terribly shy when scientists would venture to propose theories that had equations in them. He would say that he couldn't follow, he wasn't up to much, he didn't know about that kind of thing. And yet, Newton, for all his intellectual might, couldn't come up with this natural selection idea that you talk about, precisely because it required abandoning a notion of God the designer that was central to him. So it's not simply a question of intellectual might. If it came to who would do well on an SAT test, no one ever could match Newton. But nonetheless, that kind of power, of intellectual power, wasn't enough to come up with natural selection.
The guest in this hour focus, Edward Dolnick. He is the author of a newly published book that's titled The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. We'll talk more in a moment, but first, a short break. This is Focus.
Benazir Bhutto, the first woman elected to lead the Muslim nation of Pakistan, was chosen by her father, Pakistan's first democratically elected president, to carry his political mantle. Join us at the next community cinema screening for Bhutto and the post-screening discussion. The film is closed captioned and the discussion will be translated by a sign language interpreter. The free screening, open to the public, is at the Champaign Public Library Tuesday evening, April 26th, from 6:30 to 9.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. The program is on the air weekday mornings 10 to noon. Tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts. He'll be visiting here in the community. He'll be with us in the studio to spend some time talking about American politics. Then Thursday at 11, the guest is David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at the Berkman Center. He's also co-director of the Harvard Law School Library Lab. We'll be talking about knowledge in the age of social media. You can see the schedule for the week by going to our website. You can also listen to past programs. It's WILL.illinois.edu. The guest in this hour of Focus is Edward Dolnick. He's a science writer, former chief science writer at the Boston Globe. He's also written for Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, other publications. He's the author of a newly published book. The title is The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. And Harper is the publisher. I want to have you talk some more about Newton. I think you write about a number of individuals in the book that are all pretty eccentric characters, and among them, Newton may in fact stand out as one of the more eccentric. In fact, you say that Isaac Newton was one of the strangest people who ever lived. So tell us about how that strangeness manifested.
All his contemporaries said so, too. This isn't a judgment looking back, only looking back. Newton was, first of all, set aside by his brilliance, set aside from everyone else. But he was as eccentric in nearly every way. He was a bad-tempered, sullen, surly man, a terrible man to cross. If you would venture the slightest criticism of him or any of his theories, you would be a lifetime enemy. He couldn't bear to publish any of his ideas for fear that someone would venture a criticism. But on the other hand, even though he didn't publish, if somebody else came along and said something that Newton had found out in private, Newton now would be furious at this person for presuming to be his rival, even though the person couldn't know that Newton in private had come up with a similar theory. He lived to be an old man. He died in his 80s, a virgin, because, among other things, he was so formidable and standoffish a character that that no one ever dared come close to him. He was born on Christmas Day. His father had died a few months before he was born. He had this notion that he, this fatherless child born on Christmas, had been anointed by God to be the one to decipher God's secrets. A kind of astonishing self-image of being different and alone and in tune with this mystic pipeline to God. But his life and his accomplishments were so strange that this singularity that he saw in himself, you can understand where it came from. He really was set apart from other people. And all his life, this was one of the dominant strands in his mental makeup, this notion that he had been touched by God and he was not like other people.
Well, just before we took the break, there was some conversation of the development of calculus and of the fact that indeed he did, and Newton did, but there was also this man named Leibniz, who apparently also developed calculus. So the big difference was that Newton developed calculus and then went on to do his work, and Leibniz developed calculus and announced that he had developed calculus. And apparently that made Newton furious because he felt that something he had done and this other guy was poaching on his territory, and there was a lifelong feud between these two guys, even though, as you point out in the book, actually Newton and Leibniz never even met.
No, they never met, but that wasn't enough to stop Newton at first from hating Leibniz and never giving in over the course of decades. And then Leibniz, under attack, fights back. He himself was quite a proud fellow. And then their disciples on both sides fight on behalf of their great masters. An astonishing, nasty, decades-long battle. It now seems that their invention was perfectly independent. Each man did his work on his own. Neither knew what the other had been up to. Newton might have forgiven Leibniz, you would think, since Newton discovered it but didn't publish it, and how was Leibniz to know? But that wasn't enough. For someone else to presume to have as much insight, as much talent as Newton did, was an unforgivable insult in Newton's view. Newton could put up with adoration. He could endure that much human contact. But the merest hint of criticism was more than he could take.
If people know anything about Isaac Newton, they will associate Newton with gravity. And there's this story about an apple. And apparently Newton himself said that somehow he was inspired by watching an apple fall. I don't know that it actually fell on his head. That, you know, I think that's the other thing.
What everyone knows about
news about
is not only that he saw an apple fall, but yes, as you say, a lot of people believe that it conked him on
it conked him on the head.
He told that story himself, so he wasn't beyond a bit of myth making. It's not likely, really, that he took seeing an apple fall to make him wonder about gravity. But it wouldn't take anybody seeing an apple fall. Everybody knew that apples fall, and that if you take your keys out of your pocket and you let go, they'll fall to the ground. It wasn't that observation that was new. What was new was to see that was worth that observation that things fall was worth thinking about, and then to think that maybe not only do apples and keys here on Earth fall, but maybe that falling has something to do with what's going on in the heavens. Before Newton, the domain of things that go on near us, keys falling, rocks falling, arrows flying through the air, that kind of thing, was seen as entirely separate from the moon going in its orbit and the planets going on their way. What Newton showed was that not only are those two domains linked, the heavenly and the earthly, but that the same set of laws governs both of them. It's the same thing.
One of the things that's striking about Newton and some of these other men that were his contemporaries is that they didn't just work in one field. They went wherever science could go. It seems astonishing that you read these descriptions of people that, you know, their brief biographies say it's not just that someone was a brilliant mathematician. Maybe not just that he was a mathematician and did physics, but we have people that were mathematician, physicists, chemists, philosophers, astronomers. They were everywhere there it was possible to go. Now, it may be the fact that each of the what you could know in all these fields was somewhat limited, more limited than it is now. But it still seems to be astonishing that people could be so diversified and so capable in so many different things.
Well, these are amazing biographies. Christopher Renze, who is a contemporary of Newton's, we know him, if we know him at all, as an architect. Christopher Wren, St. Paul's Cathedral, churches all over London, and it's brilliant architecture. But that was only one side of it. He was famous in his day as an astronomer or mathematician. The architecture comes late. Robert Boyle, another contemporary, yet another of Newton's enemies, this bad-tempered, skinny, hunched, surly figure, was so versatile that he's, in some biographies, he's the Leonardo da Vinci of England, they say. Yes, astonishing versatility. Part of the notion was that there weren't the boundaries that you have between fields because everything was God's work, and your task as a scientist was to pay homage to God, and therefore you would look where your interests lay. If it drew you toward mathematics, if it drew you towards the natural world, towards plants and flowers, this was all fine. You're all in those different branches, decoding God's handiwork in each of those fields.
Well, you wonder, though, is it the case, for example, that that Isaac Newton was smarter than Stephen Hawking, or is it that it actually was possible for someone who was, we'd acknowledge the fact that they were brilliant, but that would have been a time and maybe one of the last times when it would be possible for a truly brilliant person to know everything? Or,
well,
you know, to the extent that anybody, you know, you could say that somebody knew everything.
Timing is everything in life. The timing of this was awfully important. And yes, to compare Newton and Hawking, say, is a fun thing. And each of them works at the frontier of his field. But just as you say, in a day when a field is brand new, you could be close to the frontier early on. Today, if you were interested in science, it takes a while. It takes college, it takes grad school, before you can ask a question that none of the experts in your field know the answer to. In the early days of these fields, nearly any question you might ask, including why do apples fall, is a question that nobody in the world knew the answer to. So the frontier was very near the starting line.
Well, I realize we're going back a ways here, but and I'm sure that Newton with calculus could tell you all kinds of things about falling apples. But did he I think some people said, well, he didn't really answer that question, why is there gravity? He could tell you how it fell, but not why.
That's exactly so. And the question that people had always wanted to know, the great classic question in science, is why is the universe the way it is? Why, when you drop a rock, does it fall? The classic answer had been because it has a natural place. The place of rocks is on the ground. The place of fire is in the air. That's why flames rise and rocks fall. When Newton came along, he didn't answer that why question, the question that everybody had assumed was the only question worth answering. What he said was, not that I have a better question, better answer to the question that everybody's been asking all along, but that's a question I'm not going to bother with. My answer is going to be to a completely different question. How do things fall? At what rate? How long does it take them? And that's what he did. And so some of his rivals, just as you say, said, well, that's all very fine, but it doesn't answer the question we really care about. Why does this happen? And Newton himself wanted to know the answer to that, but he said, we can't do that. We can't answer that question. Maybe someday we'll be able to. And so he didn't provide a better answer, but a new answer. And science to this day has taken how to be a more fruitful question than why. To why, the answer for us is often, it just so happens. But how, we can tell you things. We can tell you how much damage the bullet will do when it arrives at its target, that kind of thing.
Well, and I think it is true, and you better correct me if I'm wrong, that still we really don't, when you ask the why question of gravity, that is exactly how does this work, that we still really don't know.
Yes, you can give answers and you can make analogies about the universe is curved in this way and that way. But how is a question we do much better at than why. In that sense, to this day, some people are frustrated with science because it doesn't speak to the questions that they most care about. All this quantitative description, they say, is very well, but that's not for me.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this hour. Focus with Edward Dalnick. We're talking about his book, The Clockwork Universe. Takes a look at the work of Isaac Newton, other members of the Royal Society, and how they helped to develop science. Maybe just back to a little bit to and a point that we were making, that you made earlier on, about how it is that we tend to see these men as basically like us, although, you know, they wore different clothes, but basically they were like us. And your point is that, no, they're really not. And one way in which they're not like us is what was the motivation, what was behind their interest in doing science. And you said that, in fact, what the fact was that these men were really quite devout. They were very religious men. They believed there was God. There was a God. That God did create the universe. And that by understanding the workings of the universe was to better understand God. So that would certainly have been one important way in which they were not so much like us. Were there some other significant ways in which you would say, keep in mind that these were very much men of their time?
Well, the religious business that you just go through is certainly vital. But in addition to that, these men are just on the cusp of the modern age. They're inventing the modern world, but they themselves are men of a medieval world. And so the beliefs they take for granted, that there are devils and angels, say, that these are perfectly real, that the devil is as real as horses and birds are, they took that for granted. Robert Boyle, this great hard-headed scientist, believed that he would go to hangings, which were very popular in England of that day. People were hanged for nearly any crime you can think of, and huge crowds, thousands of people would gather, and the hangmen would then sell off souvenirs to the eager crowds. And one of the most coveted souvenirs was a hanged prisoner's severed hands, because hands contained death sweat, and death sweat held the power to heal. And Robert Boyle, this great scientist, believed that and would buy these hands. That kind of thing, that these men, if we were able to peek inside their minds, we would find glimmers of modern notions like mathematics governs the world, but also these to us bizarre notions about death sweats and witches and unicorns and God knows what.
And Newton himself was interested and dabbled in alchemy. Now, I suppose you can argue, well, that's really where chemistry begins, but that there it was maybe had equal elements of science and mysticism mixed together.
It's a kind of, to us, a magical occult witch's brew kind of a belief. Newton went about his alchemy in utterly scientific fashion, in the sense that he was very careful what he did, and he wrote it down, and he would try experiments. But what he was after was this kind of Frankenstein's brew of what is it that makes life, and where does it come from, and is there some vital essence that makes the difference between a frog and a rock, say? What is this mysterious life potion? So these are kind of sorcerer's questions, magical questions that he was after, and that he regarded as every bit as serious as the work on gravity and light and things like that, that we consider his legitimate work.
Yeah, certainly.
It was all legitimate.
Scientists of the time did some rather outlandish things, particularly as they were trying to understand things like health and illness. Things that, at least to us, seem particularly outlandish, but perhaps if you were working your way up from a pretty elementary knowledge of the body, and to, depending on what your theories of health and illness were, maybe you would just try anything.
Nearly anything goes, and when you read about these early meetings of the Royal Society, the meetings sound like gatherings of the most curious, most reckless Cub Scouts. They're constantly flinging things into the fire in the hopes that they'll explode. They're arranging transfusions between one kind of creature and another, or between a person and a lamb, say, in the hopes that when they exchange blood, something strange and marvelous we'll see. They've got no good reason to expect anything in particular. They just want to see what will happen. And so they're constantly setting up experiments of the most reckless kind, putting animals inside a jar and pumping out the air to see if they'll live or die, trying to make those jars so big that they can put themselves in and see if they'll live or die.
It must have, you know, given the fact that these men were brilliant, but also they were eccentric and they had strong egos. You wonder how it is they actually managed all to be in the same room at the same time. And maybe sometimes they couldn't all be in the same room at the same time.
Yes, there was an awful lot of door slamming and of stalking out and never speak to me again. Newton's great enemy, Robert Hooke, was president of the Royal Society for years and years, and Newton wouldn't show up because Hooke had dared to say that he had thought of some ideas before Newton had. And finally, when Hooke died, then Newton, the great eminent Newton, takes over as president of the Royal Society. And at that point, the Royal Society moved from one building to another, and the only loss in that move was the only known portrait of Robert Hooke, somehow lost in the move.
Hmm. Well, we have maybe about a minute or so left. Maybe just as a way of wrapping up, I can ask you to talk and justify, in a sense, the element of your subtitle that says that the work of Newton and the Royal Society and these other scientists, what we have here is the birth of the modern world.
Yes, the 1660s was a time that that Newton and the scientists of his day thought the world was about to end. They thought that it had been prophesied in the Bible that the end was nigh, and they had calculated, and it was just now. It was about 1660. Everything was going to go up in flames. It turns out that that was exactly wrong, that 1660 was in hindsight, the birth of the modern age. It was the time when scientists came up with the rules that govern the operation of the world. They showed that things don't just so happen, but they follow according to mathematical laws. And it's that belief and that faith that still governs science and engineering and technology today. That was a new idea, and it was first dreamed up in around 1660 in England.
Well, it's a good story, and if people would like to read more about these eccentrics and their work and how they contributed to the development of science, the book to look at is The Clockwork Universe. The subtitle is Isaac Newton, The Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. Harper is the publisher, and our guest, Edward Dolnick, is the author. He's former chief science writer at the Boston Globe and has also written for a number of publications, among them Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, and others. And Mr. Dolnick, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.